You are listening to 88.5 KRFY, community-supported radio for the Idaho Panhandle. Good morning. You're also listening to the Tuesday Morning Show. This is Julie Calamine, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Julie. How are you?
Well, great. Very great.
Are you enjoying our spring weather?
I certainly am, and I bet you are, too.
Well, it has to be worried, though. Our road's breaking up horribly, and I'd love to get the cross-country skis out a few more times. It is only early February.
Yes, it's an odd winter, and I think snow is about to come, and let's just talk about weather so that the folks that like snowshoeing, skiing, etc. can be heartened.
Give us some reason for hope.
Yes, there we go. So today we can expect a slight chance of snow, high of 38. It's a 20% chance. A little bit of partly sunny weather later today, which is nice to see, a bit of sun. That's going to continue through until Wednesday, which will also be a day of partly sunny and a high of 38. Some patchy freezing fog. We're getting used to that. Then Wednesday night, we're looking at clouds, and Thursday, it looks like snow again. 70% chance with a high in the high 30s. So snow Thursday right through till Sunday, chances of snow.
Just in time to move inside on Valentine's Day and cuddle up, right?
Oh, it's perfect weather for Valentine's Day.
Do you have big plans for the weekend, for Valentine's weekend?
Boy, no. Not yet. What about you, Phil?
We're going away. Yeah.
Good for you.
Taking a four-day weekend and going away.
All right. Well, don't tell us all the details. You don't want to be flooded with
friends. Undisclosed locations.
All right. Very good. Well, we've got a really interesting guest this morning, one I've been looking forward to talking with. And that guest is Kira Sitari. Good morning, Kira.
Good morning.
Kira, you're the Regional Communications Manager for the Idaho Fish and Game.
That's correct.
And our topic this morning is, all things big animal, small animal, and even down to some fish.
Heck yeah, we got a lot going on, so thank you for having me. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you do as Regional Communications Manager and how you came to do it. What's your background in it?
Sure. So my job is to get information out to folks like you guys, spread the word about the good things that Fish and Game is doing out there on the landscape, answer questions. I work a lot with the media. I also run our education program as well, so helping kids learn, getting teachers informed. So it's a pretty broad job and really fun. My background is actually in biology. I came up as a biologist, a fish biologist specifically. I'm a Minnesota gal myself, Julie, and grew up playing on the lakes, so it was a natural fit to grow up and become a fish biologist. Explored a lot around the West, but I really got hooked on Idaho. I had a job working out of the Middle Fork of the Salmon River out of Taylor Ranch. Fish and Game would fly me into the field station, and I would tag fish out there, and who would not just fall in love with Idaho and stick around after that?
There's no going back, is there?
No.
And so how did you come to the communication side rather than the research part? It seems like for some people, that might be a grand promotion, great vision, great opportunity. For others, it might be, I got the desk job now.
Oh, yeah. And there is a trade-off for sure. Part of it was I really had scratched that itch. I had done a ton of field work. It was so fun to share those stories of being out in the field, sharing those photos of the cool work and handling critters. And I felt like that's where I could make a difference with my career moving forward. It wasn't so much wrangling critters and squeezing fish anymore. It was sharing the stories of being out in the field.
And so how long have you been here in the Panhandle region?
I've been in the Panhandle now for 4 years. I've been in the communications position for a little over a year now.
And how has that transition gone? It's a big difference working in communications.
Oh, yeah. It's been fascinating. It's really busy. I was just so surprised at how many media requests we get in a given week, and all that is due to folks being really interested and engaged in their wildlife, people asking questions, and journalists following up on that. So it's busy, it's fun, and
So far, so good. And you are based in Coeur d'Alene, but do you travel throughout the state?
I stay up in the Panhandle region. So basically, I cover the area from the St. Joe River Basin north to the Canadian border.
And Idaho Department of Fish and Game does so much. At this point, we have to launch into some of the stuff because
let's jump in.
We have a really packed morning show this morning. And let's start off with the first topic on the list here, the large mammal ecology study. What's Fish and Game up to with that?
Yeah, so we have folks on the ground today in northern Idaho in Game Management Unit 1 up here in Bonner County. We are working on this big ecology study to look at interactions between big game animals, elk, moose, deer, and predators, black bear, mountain lion, and wolves, and how they all work together and how our management affects these populations. So if you think of classical ecology studies, you think of like lynx and snowshoe hares, their populations following each other. We have a good handle on single species or maybe two species interacting with each other, but now we're trying to do this big grab of seven different big game animals, how they interact with each other and us. So, yeah,
it's big. Tell us about the methodology.
Yeah, so right now we have trapping going on. So we have clover traps on the ground, which are used to capture elk and deer. So this is a way we can get the deer on the ground and collared. So what we're doing is avoiding drugs, because you don't want to release this groggy animal out into the wild after you put a collar on them. So we're
That's an unfair advantage for the predator.
I know. And that would mess up the study too, as a scientist. You don't want to do that. So
tell us what tell us about a clover trap.
Yeah, it kind of just funnels the critters into the trap, and then you're able to close this trap up on them, so narrow the space down more and more, and once you close it on them, you can lay them on the ground, put a little wrap over their head so they stay calm, and then we put a GPS collar on them. Mm-hmm.
How long are the collars active?
Typically, they can last several years. I mean, the battery life on these things are really amazing. It depends on how much we're using the collars and what they're geared for, because some collars are made to drop off when the animals get bigger. We have a lot of elk calves that we're collaring, and once their necks get too big, these are made to drop off so they don't hurt the animals.
So what are you hoping to gain? What kind of information from the collars?
So the collars tell us where the animals are hanging out. They're very specific GPS collars, so we can figure out where the animals are hanging out and figure out what they're eating based on that information. And then the big thing we can find out is how they're dying. We want to know what killed them. Is it a mountain lion? Is it wolf? Is it maybe malnutrition? So what happens? These collars, when they stay put for more than 8 hours, they give off a mortality signal. So an animal stops moving for more than 8 hours, our biologists get a text message from the collar that says, "I'm dead, come get me." And so we have to run out in the field and go do basically a crime scene investigation and figure out what killed that animal based on clues like tracks and scat and body condition of the animal.
Interesting.
And so you've got one half of the cast of characters here that you're getting information on. And by those CSI investigations, you're gaining some insight in the other cast of characters. Tell us, though, about the predators. Are you monitoring their movements somehow?
Yes. So those critters are also getting collars put on. We'll be doing some mountain lion captures coming up, and that'll use hounds to tree the cats and then put a collar on those. So we will have to tranquilize those animals for safety of the biologists and the animals. And we'll be able to see their movements, and we'll be collaring wolves as well. So we'll be able to see how cats and wolves and black bears all overlap on the landscape.
That is a pretty impressive sort of study.
It's a big grab.
It's pretty cool, especially if you could watch them both in real time do that dance.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'd like to ask you about cameras and hare traps. Is any of that part of the study?
Yes, so cameras are huge up here. Traditional wildlife surveys were aerial surveys. Our techniques were developed down in southern Idaho, where you have a lot less vegetation to try and look through. So cameras are playing a huge part up here in northern Idaho to get a better handle on just how many critters are out there on the landscape. So we've been putting cameras out for the last year for most species, wolves actually even longer the cameras have been out, just trying to get counts and ratios of moms to calves, stuff like that. But it's a new tool. Obviously, it's not the same as putting a collar out on an animal, but it gives new information. And you get information on a lot of other animals, too, that happen to pass by those cameras.
So all this data, all this data is coming in. Too early to draw any conclusions? You're just at the start of the study?
Yeah, honestly, we are just starting to kick it off. We did put out a wolf population estimate because the wolf cameras have been out a little longer than most of the other cameras on the landscape. So that is a new statewide wolf population estimate, which came out to be about 1,500 wolves during the summer right after pups are born. So that's kind of the peak of the wolf population estimate for the state after hunting and trapping seasons, kind of around this time of year, you get down into the about 1,000 wolves.
Yeah, so that was last summer, that number,
and
so the estimate's lower now.
Yes.
And put that into some context for us, because those numbers are different than previous studies, but also the methodology is different. So how does that impact the estimates?
Yeah, so we had an estimate back when the wolves were delisted, and the goal of meeting the population estimate that the Fish and Wildlife Service had was 150 wolves for the state. We just wanted to know that we had hit that number and had enough breeding pairs to hold that number. What we've transitioned to now is getting away from recovery and more to management of wolves. So we needed a better handle on how many wolves there were on the landscape instead of just, you know, is the population increasing, decreasing? Can we hold it with the current harvest rates?
Kira, we're going to talk about more about wolves in a moment, but before we move on to that, answer for me if you can, have there been any really interesting species sighting that you can share with us in the cameras?
You know, going to get those cameras, our wildlife biologists describe it as Christmas Day, because you just, I mean, you get millions of photos and you never know what's going to pop up on the cameras. Wolverines are always exciting. Let's see. We put out a camera on an elk scavenge, and just seeing the multitude of animals that will come and scavenge. It's bald eagles and crows to bobcats to coyotes. Just, I mean, this huge lineup of critters coming through. So that was one of the more fun cameras that I've looked at.
That does sound fun.
One camera tells you some interesting things. You get some great photos, but it's the multitude, it's the network of cameras that provides the sense of distribution and population estimates and all.
Right, yeah. And I mean, we have a huge grid out there on the landscape right now. And hopefully next time I'm in the studio, we'll be able to give you more specifics about how many wolves are in the panhandle. I mean, our methodology is getting better and better. So our confidence in these estimates will get better. And
And the results of the larger, more integrated study will provide some data on population for elk, moose, the other ungulates as well.
Right. I mean, as managers of these populations, we only have so many knobs to turn. And I mean, the biggest one is managing hunting seasons and regulations. So if we change those different knobs, does that affect our populations? Is it more weather-based instead? I mean, just how much control do we have?
There's two sides to that, of course. You're talking about the seasons and managing the game hunt for the ungulates, but also for the predator hunt.
Right, yeah. It's a lot of moving parts, and it's, you know, a multi-predator, multi-prey system that we are just trying to get a better handle on.
Data certainly has to be at the heart of it.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why we're pretty cautious about not putting numbers out at a really small scale yet. You know, we want to definitely put it through rigorous peer review.
And I'd just like to point out before we move on, it really is going to be helpful for the panhandle, because Phil and I, it's been maybe 4 years, we've been talking with Idaho Fish and Game on these topics. And almost every year we hear we have an estimate for the panhandle, but it's not like southern Idaho. This will help for the panhandle.
Right. It's been many years since we've had an elk estimate, which, I mean, really is Fish and Game's bread and butter. We have been trying to get a good population estimate, and now we really have the tools to do it.
So the The wolf population estimates that you've made, are in part driven by, but also driving some of the questions of adaptive management for the wolf as a predator.
Right.
So tell us a little more about what you've learned, what the department has learned, and how it's being applied.
Sure. So as I said, we've moved away from endangered species recovery with wolves to management of wolf populations. One of the indicators that we've used, since we haven't had an estimate on numbers of wolves, has been our elk populations. How well are they doing? And that has informed wolf management. Are we meeting elk goals? And do we need to be managing this predator? And for some areas, the answer has been yes. So Fish and Game has increased the number of wolf hunting tags, hunting and trapping tags for wolves. And currently we have proposals out. Actually, the comment period ended yesterday, but we have proposals out for more changes to the wolf management plan.
Yes, and it appears to be longer wolf seasons, different variety of trapping, just overall larger harvest due to the new survey.
Right, and so up here in Bonner Boundary County, Game Management Unit 1, we're looking at a longer hunting season on public land. So that would extend mostly from in the spring to early summer. And that would align a little better with bear hunting. So folks that were out hunting bears could still legally harvest a wolf if they happened to run into one and wanted mm-hmm. to do that.
So in our area, the likely outcome, after all the analysis is done, it would be a longer wolf season. But in some other parts of the state, there's proposals. And tell me how much of the proposals are legislative versus from the department for wolf-free zones.
Right. So wolf-free zones came up. Senator Brackett from Southern Idaho introduced a bill. The crux of it was keeping wolves out of the basically south of I-84, keeping wolves from encroaching further south on these agricultural lands where there might be a lot of conflict with ranchers. The other half of that proposal for wolf-free zones included units that had chronic depredation issues. So chronic issues where wolves were attacking and killing ranch animals. So that wouldn't affect anything up in our neck of the woods, but closer to McCall and Salmon, there were some chronic wolf depredation mm-hmm. issues. So that legislation actually got rolled into our proposals. So folks have been commenting on the wolf-free zones through Fish and Game's comment period. We actually had over 7,000 comments come in about the wolf proposals. So people have been tuning in and engaged in that conversation.
Any early sense of where those comments lie? I'm sure there's a spectrum.
Absolutely. So you really get a lot of the non-supporters, but they're polarized. So there's reasons to not support, both on we want more wolf hunting and trapping versus we want no wolf hunting and trapping. So that is certainly something our wildlife managers will have to sort through in the coming weeks. And
so does the department have a position on the legislation?
So we're supportive of it. We did react to that legislation, and by bringing it into our proposals, we just said we do want to work with the senator and basically roll it under our program.
And was the legislation passed? I know I should probably know it, but I don't know the answer.
It was introduced. It hasn't been passed.
All right. Yeah.
It's a short legislative season, though, so we
will
know soon. I want to pull something into this conversation we were going to talk about later, but it seems like as part of the tools that determine some of the management recommendations for predators as well as elk, ungulates, there was an elk depredation study done in southern Idaho, which had a large number of mortalities that were part of the study. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. folks would have seen this on social media. It just got picked up last week in the Spokesman Review. It honestly didn't make the department look too great. So what happened was 206 elk were killed by sharpshooters as part of a University of Idaho Fish and Game depredation study. So there are areas down in the Magic Valley specifically that were getting hit really hard by large elk herds, damaging crops. These are people's livelihoods, and Fish and Game is responsible to pay damages back to farmers that have lost their crops. So in 2018, the department paid $1.5 million in depredation damages from elk. And we were looking at ways to try and reduce those damages. One of those tools was reducing the herd numbers. So we took, we had to use sharpshooters at night because that's when the elk were on the crops. Our tools up here are usually issuing tags to hunters. That's certainly our preferred method, but down in that area, it just wasn't an option. So over a 3-month period, there were a lot of elk harvested. That certainly has an emotional effect on folks to hear that many elk were killed. I can say that all the meat went to food banks, but it was done over a 3-month period. It wasn't overnight that these elk were killed. So
it was part four agricultural control, if that's exactly the right term, but part for control.
Right.
And then there was a study element to it as well.
Yeah. So it was an experimental design. Sharpshooting was one of the methods, but there were also other alternatives, like using dogs to chase off the elk from the crops, using chemical sprays to make the crops less palatable. So obviously reducing the elk numbers in a certain area isn't the go-to approach, but it was one. And in that area specifically, early results suggest that, you know, depredations did decrease.
And so you're saying that a number of methods were used and studied, not just shooting.
Right. Like, and the study's not done, so I can't say what worked best, but we should know in the next few months.
Phil. It is so difficult, that the whole problem. And in reading further about it, I noticed that the average claim per depredation claim was like $75,000. So this is not a small problem. It's a very big problem for landowners.
Right. Yeah. And we don't see it as much in northern Idaho. We don't have as big a agricultural tracts, and we don't have as big of elk herds either. So hearing, you know, 200 elk, that's actually less than 1% of the population down there.
So is any part of the study looking at the relationship to prey predator? For example, the presence or absence of other predators on the elk population that were doing the damage?
Not that I'm aware of. That's a very good question. So the predator prey work is starting up here in northern Idaho and isn't implemented yet in southern Idaho. Granted, a lot of this is part of the wolf free zone, so they just don't have the wolf habitat down there. But there's certainly many other predators, and I haven't...
It could be an argument against the wolf-free zone.
Could be, yeah.
And, you know, lots of comments on those articles. And I did notice one as I was reading the article about the fact that some landowners allow hunting on their land, others do not. And, of course, if you're not allowing hunters on your land, I would think you would be exposed to more potential depredation.
Right. And hunters are our number one tool to deal with these issues. So, as I said, up here in northern Idaho, we've had a lot of success using hunters to reduce depredations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Complicated.
Complicated topic. But yes, if you have the absence of predators and you have the absence of hunters, then you have a ripe condition for elk.
Sure. Yeah.
So let's... unless there's other things we want to talk about with the wolf study or the mammal study, a couple other quick things before we take a song break. Know a lot of our listeners are wondering, you didn't mention mountain goats in the study. They're in a different habitat zone.
Right.
But there are ongoing studies related to mountain goats.
Yeah, so we are on deck this year to do a aerial survey for mountain goats. That was originally going to happen this January, but as you guys were commenting on the odd winter, usually we have about 15 days to do aerial surveys in January. This winter we had 3. So we got our elk work done and had to push the mountain goat survey back until late spring. But we will be flying the Selkirks and the Cabinets to look at mountain goat populations.
That'd be fun. If you need a volunteer, let me
know. Yes.
Phil, I was about to volunteer.
Other recent changes? I know you wanted to talk about the upland game season.
Sure. This is just something I wanted folks to be aware of up here. You know, you see a lot of turkeys in backyards and on farms this time of year. I wanted to let folks know that the commission has approved a longer fall turkey hunting season that'll extend. Right now it ends December 31st. It'll go to the end of January starting next year. So a longer time to get on top of those turkeys that might be causing some nuisance or depredation issues themselves up here in Unit 1.
I have a feeling you wouldn't have many arguments about reducing that population a bit.
You'd be surprised, actually. I mean, turkeys are fun to watch. Some folks are feeding them, and some neighbors right next door want them all gone. So, it is still contentious.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing the reactions that people have run across the gamut when it comes to wildlife, whether they're a nuisance or an attraction.
That's absolutely true. But that's what makes being the communications manager fun, is you can have those conversations and hear all those different viewpoints
and increase understanding.
Yeah.
Let's take a short song break, and then we'll be back to new topics for Fish and Game. For those of you just joining us, this is KRFY 88.5 FM, listener supported community radio for the Idaho Panhandle. This is the Tuesday morning show, and we'll have a little song that might remind
Lyle Lovett and his bear song. It don't come no better than a bear. You're listening to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And we are this morning on the morning show talking with Kira Sitari, regional communications manager for Idaho Department of Fish and Game. If you missed any of the first part of the interview, you'll want to be sure to download the podcast later on. It's just been chock full with great information. And we're going to turn to a couple new topics, new for this morning anyway. Chronic wasting disease, not here yet, but on our doorsteps.
Yes. So if folks don't know about this disease, it is a disease that affects deer, elk, and moose. It is 100% fatal. It's a neurological disease, and it makes it really tough for biologists to get a handle on, because it's not a virus. It's not a bacteria. It's actually a misfolded protein that affects the nervous system of these animals. So you can't burn it out. You can't fix it with a fever. It is a crazy disease that's been around for several years now, but not in Idaho. It
sounds a little bit like the mad cow disease that was prevalent about 2 decades ago.
Yes, that is the same. It's called a prion, is actually what is shared between animals, so through urine or saliva. And it can be taken up in plant roots and eaten by animals and spread. So it's very, very contagious.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, but so far as is known, it's not transferred by eating the meat to humans.
Right.
But we don't know that for sure.
Right. So the CDC does not recommend eating the meat of an infected animal with CWD, and Fish and Game follows those recommendations as well. There's been no evidence of transmission through eating the meat yet, though.
Yes, even though it has happened from cows to human, and there's a sort of a version of it in squirrels, correct?
Oh, I actually don't know about the squirrels.
I believe so. In Kentucky, I think there have been, but now I'm not the expert.
Well,
so.
No,
I'm going to have slightly annoyed squirrel disease.
Crazy squirrels. Yes.
And by on our doorsteps, in our listenership, we reach into parts of Montana that have experienced this recently, as
right.
close as Libby.
Yes. So last year, deer mostly in town of Libby were tested positive for chronic wasting disease or CWD. You know, we were sitting pretty comfortable in the panhandle. We knew it was in Wyoming around Tetons. We didn't expect it to pop up around Libby, and then it did. So there's been, I lost track after 20 deer tested positive out of Libby, and then two bull moose actually tested positive just south of Libby. So it's right on our border. So,
oh boy.
What can be done? Detection?
Right. So Fish and Game really bumped up surveillance with detections just across the border. You can expect regular testing of what we look at are lymph nodes in deer, elk, and moose. So annual testing now, we'll be asking for lymph nodes at check stations every year, I would guess. And then collecting lymph nodes as well from roadkill. So we've been working with ITD to get samples as well. So this year, our check stations in northern Idaho collected over 500 samples from deer, elk, and moose. And so far, we have not had a detection, knock on wood.
Mm. How true. And the check stations, of course, are excellent. Can folks voluntarily bring their own deer in for testing?
Right, yeah. Anytime you want to bring a harvested animal in, our biologists will take those lymph nodes out at the office. During the hunting season, we also have freezers where folks can just drop off heads of harvested animals and get those tested.
Is it recommended that hunters do that?
Yes, we do recommend it. Not just increases our ability to confidently say CWD is not here yet, but it's peace of mind for the hunters.
Mm-hmm. If you shot a trophy, your trophy deer of your lifetime, will you get the head back?
That is an excellent question. So if you shot it over in Montana, get it processed, get the taxidermy done in Montana. You cannot move it across state borders.
Mm, got it. All right. And many of us will shoot a deer and want to get it processed, et cetera, and may or may not have it tested for chronic wasting. There are some techniques that are recommended for safe processing.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, basic sanitation, using gloves. There's been some very recent studies looking at heavy bleach solutions, being able to clean off tools. But, I mean, keep your hunting tools separate from your butchering tools. And really don't move animal parts around, especially brain and spinal tissues. We want to keep those in the same place that you shot the animal. The other recommendation I have across the board is not to feed animals. Deer and elk and moose in particular, you don't want to congregate them in the same place. It just makes disease transmission all the more likely.
And that's true whether you're talking about the salt block grain at a farm or even here in town.
Right.
Don't feed the moose.
Yes. So, I mean, there's a lot of good reasons not to feed the animals. One, I mean, it's just not good for their digestive system. There's plenty of food out there on the landscape for them to find. It also congregates animals in town, which can cause traffic issues or safety issues for residents. I mean, an angry moose expecting a handout from a small kid can be a terribly dangerous situation, or coming after a small dog. So we just want to avoid those conflicts, and not feeding wildlife during the winter is one of those solutions.
Yeah, always good advice. One of the other conflicts on our list to talk about today, as we look at how wildlife moves across corridors in the landscape, is the unfortunate tragic incident where a herd of pronghorn were killed in a train collision recently in southeastern Idaho.
Right. So this was down by the city of Hamer. About 60 pronghorn were killed by a train colliding with them. So what happened was a lot of these animals were funneled away from the interstate towards the tracks, and what was happening, it was very blowing and drifting snow out there, and the only bare spots were the plowed railroad tracks. So the pronghorn could get around a little easier, and we're using the train corridor to move around, and we're hanging out, and unfortunately a bunch got hit recently.
Yeah, so much we could talk about and unpack there, maybe for another show, about wildlife corridors and mitigation of movements. But
I mean, fencing is a big conversation with that. In this case, it may not have helped because they were looking for that plowed, snow-free area to hang out in. So,
Yeah, similar to our highways in the winter and the spring when salt is melting along the roadside, we have to be so careful.
Right, absolutely. And that is just around the corner. So we certainly encourage folks to keep their eyes
slow
open
down
on the road.
Watch out. We know just again over the border of Montana about the number of collision incidents with bighorn sheep on the highways.
Yes, yes.
So closer to home, closer to your field office, the Wolf Lodge Bay Eagles. It's a delight for everybody every winter. But this year, the eagle numbers seem to be down a little bit.
Right. So usually those eagle counts peak right around Christmas and New Year's, and that lines up awesome with Christmas break. So we get folks out at Wolf Lodge Bay viewing those eagles. And this year, numbers were down a bit. Unfortunately, we can't say a lot about population or what that means. So those birds are migratory. They're moving through from Canada, headed south to Salt Lake in California. And it may have been they came through earlier. It may have been the kokanee that they're feeding on spawned a little earlier this year. Our spawning ground surveys would indicate that. We also had a smaller year class of kokanee in Lake Coeur d'Alene, not a red flag for us. These populations are up and down, and we know there's a good year class coming up behind those fish. So 1 year doesn't have me hitting the panic button, but it's certainly something that we're working with BLM and other folks to monitor.
Good. Well, they may have all been up on the Kootenai. I attended the Bonners County or the Bonners Ferry annual Audubon bird count, and there were no shortage of eagles along the river.
That's totally true, Julie. So we're just looking at the Coeur d'Alene area. We don't even do a count on the Ponderay. So maybe they were just up north.
Elsewhere. Yeah. They might have been.
They were, there's a congregation of them here locally along Lakeshore Drive we see every winter, and their numbers were down this winter, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that could explain why they're some of it, if they're going to the Kootenai, and that's a segue into our next thing. Maybe the recovery of the burbot had something to do with the eagles going up there, although they're bottom feeders, aren't they?
Yeah, so, that would be a big leap.
That'd be a big
dive. I'm not going to shoot it down completely, but a burbot. I did want to talk about this because right now is prime burbot fishing season. So if you haven't heard of this fish, they're also called ling cod. They're only in the Kootenai River in Idaho. They're these native fish. In 2004, their population bottomed out. We think there were only about 50 fish in the river. And now today, there's probably around 40 to 50,000 fish in the river. And there's a fishing season that opened last year. So we want folks to get out and use that fishery. And it's picking up. We had nets in the water between Deep Creek and the city of Bonners Ferry. Just yesterday, they pulled 60 fish out of their nets. So
neat.
Burbot are in the river, and we want folks to get out there and chase them.
A big success story. And again, we did a whole show on that about a year ago.
Yeah, you had TJ Ross in.
Yeah,
yes.
A fabulous topic, and maybe we should have him back and delve more
Definitely.
Into it. But give us a thumbnail sketch of how that success came to be.
Sure. It is a partnership like all conservation success stories. So the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho and University of Idaho worked together to build an aquaculture facility. So burbot had never been raised in a hatchery before. We didn't know how to do it. And then with Bonneville Power Administration funding, this hatchery was built. We figured out how to raise these fish successfully. So the hatchery is the main driver right now of the burbot population. And Fishing Game continues to do research to try and figure out now how can we boost that natural reproduction in the river as well. So, it's really interesting with a lot of more questions to answer.
And they're, of course, a river fish. So folks are out either on the banks or floating, trying to catch them ice fishing. What is the year like for the ice fishermen? It doesn't seem very icy.
It's a sad year for the ice fishermen. You can find some good ice on smaller lakes. I don't even have the most recent report. It's hard to even keep up with what has good ice. Mm-hmm. Be safe out there, folks, and make sure you're checking your ice conditions as you walk out there.
That's right.
Good advice every year, but this year particularly, it seems.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about some of the announcements you have, a few things you wanted to talk about that are coming up.
Yes, thank you. So next Tuesday, we have a graduate student from University of Idaho coming up to the Coeur d'Alene office for our sportsman's breakfast. So it's a little early. It starts at 7 a.m., but he'll be talking about black bear research. That ties into the large mammal ecology study that I talked about at the top of the hour. And then moving on,
Sure. Where is that? And can the public attend?
Yes, absolutely. Public is welcome. No RSVP needed. We have a little continental breakfast at 6:30 a.m. at the regional office in Coeur d'Alene. And then the presentation starts at 7 a.m.
I've never been to one. I think I'm going to have to get myself up and
this would be a good one to come to if you're going to come
Tuesday, Julie.
Oh, that's why, Phil. That explains it.
We can't both go anyway.
All right.
We'll have to arm wrestle for it later.
All right.
So moving on, we have a Project Wild workshop coming up February 21st and 22nd. This is a workshop for teachers and educators. We encourage camp counselors or scout leaders to come to this. Basically, we give these educators tools to teach kids about wildlife. So the target audience, K-12 students, we have a bunch of activities and curriculum books that we give folks and teach them how to teach about Idaho wildlife.
And that's the 21st and 22nd?
Right. That is down in Coeur d'Alene as well. Spots are still available, and we certainly encourage folks to sign up for that. It's in the evening on Friday, so you don't have to take off work, and then all day on Saturday.
What a great way to get kids thinking about our fish and game.
Yeah, and this is this project or program has been going on for a long time.
Yes, and more we're leaning on train the trainer kind of workshop. So, I mean, I'm one communications manager. I have a permanent staff of one other person. So trying to reach all the schools out there, we certainly want the teachers to jump in and get involved.
So who are the folks that attend? Are they mostly public school, private school, other type of educators?
It is mostly public school teachers, but we certainly get a fair share of daycare professionals. The homeschool groups come in. All the curriculum is linked to Idaho standards, so you aren't expanding into and adding more to your annual teaching plan. It weaves right into what you're already learning with social studies and math and stuff like that.
And are there programs for all the grade levels, or is it focusing on one?
So the focus is kindergarten through 12th grade. I will say we usually don't get a lot of high school teachers because they're so bogged down with grad standards and stuff like that. But yes, the material is appropriate for that large range group.
And so if someone's interested, how do they sign up?
You can go on our website, go to Idaho Fish and Game, and look up the education section, and you'll find Project Wild in there, and you can register online.
And I would like to take a moment and talk about that website. Phil, you have to have been there, and I visited it this morning and other times. It is a wonderful resource.
Sure. Yeah. You're going to see on the front page that there's a news feed. So today, I mean, there's information on the train collisions and the wolf proposals. And then it's, organized by wildlife, education, anything you need information on.
It's a great resource. And I'm assuming that associated with the website are the regular series of emails that Idaho Department of Fish and Game puts out, and I'm on the list. And they're a fabulous resource for information on almost all the topics we've talked about today. And I'm assuming you have some role in that.
I do. So I coordinate our regional newsletter that folks can sign up for on the website. And honestly, we'll just kind of digest a lot of the local stories, statewide stories that affect folks up here in the Panhandle. So you can sign up for that list at idfg.idaho.gov as well.
And for listeners who haven't been there, it really is not just rules and regulations and news stories. There are great educational articles, almost anything you might need to learn about related to fish and game. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
I certainly encourage folks to go poke around on there. There's a lot of...
They're presented in a very nice, easy-to-digest fashion.
I will pass that on to our folks down in Boise. They will appreciate it.
Thank you. Let's see. Last but certainly not least, upcoming public meeting on the Chinook salmon.
Yes. So usually we don't have anadromous salmon meetings up here in the Panhandle, but we've heard from enough sportsmen that we are bringing the salmon fishery managers up to Coeur d'Alene on February 25th. That is also at the Coeur d'Alene Regional Office. That's in the evening. It starts at 5 p.m. It'll be open house style, so you can come whenever you want and talk to managers and learn a little bit about what's going on in salmon fisheries.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and is there a bit of early news on how they're doing this winter?
I actually don't have the update, and that's part of the reason for the meeting is that there's not a looming decision point right now. We want to get folks informed about trends and what's going on. There's not a big emergency with salmon at the moment, but we want to start the conversation now about what our sportsmen are expecting and what really is biologically possible with salmon.
It's important to get public input.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, Kira, this has been so wonderful. We probably ought to have you on more often.
I would be happy to come up.
There's an open invite. We'll have to talk about the next best time to come.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. If anyone has questions, our regional office number is 208-769-1414. You can talk to me or any of our biologists or check out our website at idfg.idaho.gov.
Very good. Well, Kira Sitari, I want to thank you for joining us this morning on the KRFY Morning Show. And as Phil said, we will invite you again, maybe an early summer update. For now, though, we'll take a song break, and then Phil and I